welcome to the Adventist Forum. Our program today is about Adventist publishing, 34 years inside Seventh-day Adventist Publishing, a retrospective by Richard Coffin, who has spent 34 years in Adventist publishing on the inside. He's a book editor, he's an executive, and I think he's going to have a lot of interesting insights to share with us. And then after his presentation, Gary will coordinate a time to ask questions and make comments and protests and whatever else. So, as we begin, Jim Hayward's going to offer a word of prayer for us.
Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this Sabbath day. Thank you for the opportunities of getting together with friends to chat about things that are meaningful to us. Be with Richard today as he speaks, we pray. Amen.
Amen. I'd just share with you a few words from the Chinese dissident writer Ma Jian. To become self-aware, people must be allowed to hear a plurality of opinions and then make up their own minds. They must be allowed to say, write, and publish whatever they want. Freedom of expression is the most basic but fundamental right. Without it, human beings are reduced to automatons. So we're going to fight reducing you to automatons today by hopefully having some freedom of expression and good ideas. Our next meeting is November 3, which is the last Sabbath before election. I'll be meeting here in Chan Shun Hall. And the reason that that's relevant is our topic is checking the political pulse of the university, findings from the 2012 SDA Religion and Social Issues Survey. Kurt Vanderwall, chair of our Department of Social Work here at Andrews University, will be leading out with two of his co-investigators on this study, John Gavin, who's chair of social work at the department at Washington Adventist, and William W. Wellis from the Center for Law and Public Policy. And they're going to be discussing their study of the social and political views of faculty and staff at the 12 SDA colleges in North America. So if you want to know how to vote, why, come and we'll tell you. And then we're also having as a discussant Edwin Hernandez, a sociologist of religion who's currently senior program officer for research, education, and congregational initiatives with the DeVos Family Foundations. And he'll serve as an external discussant. You may recall he has spoken to the forum before and has co-authored two earlier studies with Roger Dudley on Adventist political attitudes. So we should have a stellar cast. Then on December 1, W. Larry Richards, who's director of the Greek Manuscript Research Center here at Andrews, is going to be talking to us on issues related to ancient manuscripts and modern versions of the Bible. So we invite you to keep those two events in mind, the first Sabbath of November and the first Sabbath of December. I just remind you, if some of you aren't getting email notifications and would like to, there's a sign-up sheet in the back where you can leave your email address. And if you have excess funds, there are also little envelopes there you can take home and send in a contribution to the forum to help us with future programs. Again, thanks to Jim Harris, who gets our audio working and records the programs so we can have them on the web. And Terry and Debbie, who help with publicity. Well, let's tell you a little bit about our speaker today. Richard Coffin is a retired publishing executive and editor. As I mentioned, his topic is 34 years inside Seventh-day Adventist Publishing, a retrospective. He's had a long career with the denomination. 6 years as a church pastor in Massachusetts, 34 years as a religious book editor, acquisitions editor, publishing executive, and senior management positions both at Southern Publishing Association, which most of us in this room can still remember, and the Review and Herald Publishing Association. He earned BA and MA degrees in systematic theology, though he says in recent years his interest and taste has turned more to biblical studies. He's been a member of the Society of Biblical Literature for over 35 years and has served as president of the Andrew Society for Religious Studies. He's the author of many articles, several books, things like Snapshots of God, Wake Up Your Bible Study, When God's Heart Breaks, When God Sheds Tears, Metaphors That Matter, and the list goes on. He says his aim has been to try to translate helpful insights so that they're accessible to the thoughtful layperson. He retired in 2004, which makes him a particularly desirable forum speaker. And he and his wife, who is a registered dietitian, live in the Omaha, Nebraska area, although they spend a lot of their time in Tucson. Did I get that straight? Okay. They have two marriage children, two grandchildren, one son. Dr. Ronald Coffin is a professor in the School of Education right here at Andrews, and he's done some interesting research that we may try to get him to talk about for him down the line. So, we will turn the time over to you and be interested in what you have to share with us.
Thank you. I can see that this has been quite a sacrifice for you folk to come out this afternoon, giving up nap time. I was going to say, feel free to continue that practice, and if I nod off during my presentation, you'll understand, won't you? Well, we can all do this together. I appreciate the invitation to be here, to see some old friends and acquaintances and a family here. And Gary, when we were in Worcester, Massachusetts, Gary was just a young guy running around. You know, he was a tremendous young person. We always looked with great affection to Gary and thought he was such an outstanding young person. Of course, now you can see what happened to him. He's here at Andrews. But it's been years since Gary and we have shaken hands or seen each other. So it's very, very much a pleasure for us, Gary, to be here. And oh, before I forget, please give your mother our greetings, too. What a privilege. My whole life has been involved in the church. Everything I am, really, I pretty much owe to our denomination. From being a preacher's kid, through the educational system, pastoral service, editorial work, retirement, all of it's been molded by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And it's, you know, educated me, employed me, remunerated me, moved me from place to place, as the churches want to do. It's covered my medical expenses. It's provided retirement income. And one of these years, it'll pay Roselia a death benefit, you know. So the church is pretty much all part of our life here. I also want to say that by and large, the denomination and its administrators have treated me not just well, but generously, and I appreciate that. And it's easy to get critical, I know, I do that at times, but I want you to know that I do hold our church in high regard and the benefits that have come with employment in the church. The church has been good to me, even on those times when it has questioned my orthodoxy. And probably none of you have ever had that happen to you, huh? But that does take place. In fact, for a while, and I don't want to get into this part of my career, but for a while, I was in what I call, I think it was 5 years of my eclipse. At the publishing house, I was demoted at my request because of health reasons. In other words, I had a twisted arm. And at the end of that time, the new president of the Review and Herald said, well, we want Richard back in to be a vice president again. And so they had a board meeting, and Al McClure was chair of the board, and he called me into the president's office before the board started, and he said, now, Richard, we're going to ask the board to make you vice president again. However, some people think you're liberal. And immediately I shot back and said, I know, Al, that's what my CPA says every year when he works on my income tax. And Al caught it just instantly caught it. It didn't take him at all. He gave me a little smile, patted me on the back, sent me out of the room, and wished me the best. During the summer of 1970, Rosalia, Bob, Ron, and I, after 6 years of pastoral work in Massachusetts, we transferred to a whole new way of life. First of all, Rosalia wasn't born in New England, but I was born there, our sons were born there, and so here these Yankees were transferred to Nashville, Tennessee, and for a while they were sure that I was one of those, well, since it's being recorded, I shouldn't say what kind of Yankees we were. But, you know, it's one word down there in the South, you know, it's one word, it's not two words down there. And so it was quite an interesting change after having been in pastoral work. And then I guess it was about a year and a half, Bob Nixon, who was my boss there, decided to leave the publishing house for a new career. He wanted to study law, and so they looked around to see someone, needed to find someone to replace Bob, and Bob, you can't replace. He was a real jewel. I always appreciated Bob Nixon. And they looked around, and they just weren't all that successful. So on December 27, 1971, the executive committee at Southern Pub met, and I'm going to quote the minutes, okay? The general manager reported on the extensive search that has been made to find an acceptable replacement for R.W. Nixon as book editor. The most desirable candidates have either declined to be considered or unavailable. Under these circumstances, it is felt that the best solution to the problem would be to go with the men we have voted, that we recommend to the board that Richard Coffin be appointed book editor. And so that is how I, the not acceptable replacement and least desirable candidate, dived into the waters of Adventist publishing, progressing from assistant book editor to associate book editor to book editor to vice president, you know, all that kind of stuff, special assistant to the president. And I retired, when I retired, I was vice president for the periodical division. Told the president, I know nothing about periodicals or periodical editing, but of course that doesn't matter in the church, does it, usually? And so they wanted me in there, and so that's where I was. I actually worked under seven different presidents or general managers. You know, they started out being general managers, and they went to the presidential system. Harold Eyrig, Len Paddock, Ross Woolard, Bud Otis, John Wilkins, Bob Kenney, and Ted Wilson. He was our president there for a while. When I started editing, I wasn't sure exactly how much do you dabble in somebody else's work, literary creation? Do you just kind of barely touch it, or what do you do? And Gerald Wheeler, born and raised in the Niles area here, maybe some of you know Gerald, assured me that we were butchers, and not to worry about what we did to other people's material. Hit that very early on. I think it may have been the first booklet that they gave me to edit there at Southern Pub, was a little booklet they had accepted that by an Adventist author that supported the Wednesday crucifixion, Jesus' Wednesday crucifixion concept. And boy, we went around and around on that. We finally set up a committee to look at it, and Bill Johnson was going to be our arbiter. He was our arbiter to help us sort through this. And you know, even today, I'm not sure whether we finally, I think we finally ended up returning it to the author, maybe at her request. It's still very hazy in my mind. But back then, you know, back in the 70s, publishing something was quite labor-intensive, especially at the editorial end of things. We would make changes on the original typescript. In fact, the contract authors would sign is that they were giving us the material object. If they didn't give us the material object, we couldn't do anything with it. And so we would do that, and then the secretary would retype the whole thing, because we were pretty aggressive editors at Southern Pub. The secretary would retype the entire book, and it would then go to the copy editors. And, you know, copy editors are the people who check all the spelling and the commas and the, you know, all that good stuff, the grammar and syntax. And they would go through, and they would make a lot of changes, usually enough changes that we would have the secretary, again, retype the whole book, the whole manuscript. And then we would send it to the author. And the author would go through it. And if the author made a lot of changes, we wanted to send clean copy to the typesetter. You remember the old linotype machines? Yeah, well, we wanted to send clean copy there. And so if there were a lot of changes from the author, usually there weren't. But if there were, it would be retyped all over again. Amazing. Before the merger in 1980, we began transitioning to a form of electronic typesetting. At first, they were punching holes in a strip of paper that was about that wide on you know, these big reels. Marvelous advance, you know. Then a few years later, after the merger 1980, the review moved to Hagerstown, Maryland, and we began investigating a new technology for typesetting actually there at your desk with your computer. Well, you really weren't using your computer. These were separate machines that you would use with flicker-proof monitors to work with. And each line editor and copy editor and proofreader would have a terminal with this non-flicker screen monitor, and it had special hardware. You could track whatever everyone did, what changes they made. Very expensive systems. We looked at a number of them. It was going to cost us several hundred thousand dollars, as I recall, if we got into that. And there was money in selling these systems, because we had gone to Baltimore to look at one system and discovered that the man who operated that business drove a Rolls Royce. It didn't do him any good, I guess, because we said, well, if he can afford a Rolls Royce, maybe we don't want to give him any more money. You know? And very shortly after that, of course, we were doing this with our own computers at our own desks. We had a big battle. Should it be WordStar? WordPerfect, you know, and finally it got down to WordPerfect at first. We were going to use WordPerfect, and finally Word seemed to catch up, and the publishing house ultimately went totally to Word. Now, as head book editor, I needed to somehow develop a philosophy of what is the publishing all about? What are we trying to do? What should our books do? Because, again, I was with books. And we wanted to provide reaffirmation, of course, of Adventist belief. We were a Seventh-day Adventist publishing house. We better do that. But also we wanted to kind of gently stir around in people's minds a little bit and see if we couldn't push back the frontiers of Adventist thought somewhat. And then, we wanted to provide some educational and entertaining, at the same time, reading for material for the church. And we decided that, as editors, we existed really for only one purpose: to make authors look good. And if an author said, as one author did to me one time when I got carried away with my writing, "It sounds more like Richard than it does Marvin Moore," I realized then I had gone too far. So we want the author to look good. We don't care about whether the editor looks good or not. The editor, he doesn't matter. It's the author who needs to look good. What a fine writer so-and-so is. That's what we want readers to say, not, oh, what a great editor Richard is who worked on somebody's manuscript. It's also easy when you're in a position like that to catch some sort of arrogance as, we're the last word, we're the authority kind of thing, and people complained about editors having yard-long noses that they haughtily peered down, looking at these little authors down here. And so we tried to be very conscious of that, dealing with, and you see, you, even when you accept a manuscript, and it's really well done, you're going to still edit it, and it gets in this long, drawn-out process of publishing, because our publishing houses don't do instant publishing by any stretch of the imagination. It's going to take a couple of years at least, usually, for your book to get out. And so, with all this going on, you're so involved with your own busyness, you forget about the authors out there. And the poor author is wondering, well, where's my manuscript? Where's my book? What's happening? And so we tried to keep authors in mind. I tried at least every quarter to send even if it's just a form letter of a few sentences to authors to let them know that we hadn't forgotten them. The publishing house still existed. It hadn't fallen into a big black hole yet. We also try to remember their birthdays once in a while, and send them a little booklet for their birthday and a letter congratulating them on another birthday. It's helpful to keep authors in the loop. Can't always do that, but it seemed to me that the highlight and the high point of an editor's work is indeed author relationships, and keep those going. While at Southern Publishing Association, I received a very polished query letter from someone named Zig Ziglar. He wanted to know if Southern Publishing Association would be interested in reviewing his next manuscript for publication. Now, I thought that was a wonderful testimony. Well, he found our name in Writer's Market, probably, SBA. But I thought, this is wonderful. This is amazing. And you know what I did? I wrote him a letter and said, thank you, but we can't provide the market that you want and need. And I have to tell you, please, don't send it to us. I thought I needed to be honest with someone and let them know, because our marketing system within the church is pretty much limited to Adventist book centers. It still is largely. So it was kind of hard. I never told the marketing people, but I did. They of course would be extremely disappointed, but so would the author. Zig Ziglar would have been extremely disappointed and actually indignant over the poor circulation his book would have had if we had accepted it and tried to publish it. It would have been a dream catch. Oh, a few authors, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, but we had some interesting authors we've dealt with over the years. There was Prophet Pearl. She had visions, and she wanted to set up a health kind of a lifestyle health living facility. And the best place she found to do this was the apartment that she and her husband rented out to Bill and Susie, or whatever the names, But Bill and Susie had a lease. Prophet Pearl wanted her husband to break the lease, and he refused. And so Prophet Pearl said, well, she was still going to go ahead with this facility, and it was going to be in this particular facility, venue. And she even sent a letter to the editor of the local newspaper in which she predicted that Bill and Susie would soon be dead. I thought that was interesting. A man in Georgia had written a Bible to the local churches in his, I don't remember if it was Atlanta or where in Georgia. And so, you know, one chapter would be to the first, the epistle to the First Baptist Church, and or the second epistle to the St. Mark United Methodist Church. This is what he had. And he had sent it, as I recall, it was to Exposition Press. And if are you familiar with what they used to call subsidy publishers or vanity publishers? Yeah, now that we can do self-publishing so easily, that kind of thing is going by the wayside. Well, he wrote to them and sent his manuscript to them, and he got this flowery letter back from the acquisitions editor. She said, "I keep my fingers on the pulse of American readers, and what you have in this book is something that they are," you know, and she went on and on. And it was only going to cost him, and it was pretty much the rest of his retirement pay for the next 10 or 20 years, you know, to get this done. And, which taught me quite a lesson about vanity publishing. One of the things in this book, this is what she was saying was so great, and she had her fingers on the pulse of American readers. This gentleman read Jesus' warning that if your eye offends you, pluck it out. If your right hand offends you, cut it off. Well, his problem was not with his eyes. His problem was not with his hands. But he discovered that when he saw a very attractive, shapely woman walking down the street, there was a problem. He wanted to follow Jesus' advice. He was a sincere person. Got to take God's word literally, you know. So he went to the local Walgreens drugstore. And he went to the pharmacy counter and he said, "I would like to buy some Novocaine." And of course he was told that he needed a prescription for that, you know. We just don't give Novocaine out over the counter. Well, he didn't have a prescription. He was disappointed, but he was resolute. This is what Jesus wanted. He went home, he found a razor blade, scrounged around, got some scissors, some salt, some ice cubes from the freezer, and he began slicing away with a razor blade. Now, ice cubes and salt don't numb real deeply, and it started hurting. So he grabbed the scissors and he finished the job. This is what these vanity publishers were saying is so great. You know, we'll do this book for you. Everybody's going to want to read this kind of book. Kara Ahman, non-Adventist. Is it Methodist Episcopalian or Episcopalian Methodist? What's that combination they have? She was in that denomination. And she sent us a little small manuscript, and it was excellent, very well done, wonderfully done. We published it. We called it Hyacinths to Feed the Soul. And it was one of these little 32-page books that would go in doctor's offices, and we sold a lot of those in doctor's offices. And then we did another one from her, Love is the Motive. Well, on a trip to California, it was my privilege to meet Kara Ahman. I took her out to lunch. Had my father come along with me, so it was all up and up, you know, and legitimate, and we had a wonderful talk. And a few years later, she wrote to me, and she had exciting news. She had published a little short story called The Last Testament. And it was about how this family living in a little town in Northern California coped with life after a nuclear holocaust there. And the story had appeared originally in the National Catholic Weekly, St. Anthony Messenger. That was in 1980. And then later in Ms. Magazine, the story was reprinted. And filmmaker Lynn Littman liked it, and he hired John Sacred Young to turn the story into a movie script. And Carol sold her rights for, I think it was $1,000, the movie rights. And they produced a television movie called Testament, which did very well. It got excellent reviews, even from people such as Robert Ebert. He said, this was so painful, frightening, and yet plausible that it left people shaking. Vanity Fair gave it a wonderful review. Seriously, the most disturbing film I've ever seen in my whole life. Beyond traumatic. Jane Alexander was the actress in the movie. She was nominated to receive an Oscar for her role in Carol Ahman's movie. Oh, it was exciting. And I had met this lady. We had published her. You know, this is fun. 1987, 7 years later, Carol threw a party for some of her closest friends. She called it, "She Lives Until She Dies, Bash." And 10 days later, at 53 years of age, Carol was gone. Died in her home in Sunnyvale, California. Adventists. Elder Frazee had a book on the sanctuary service. He called it Ransom and Reunion. It was fun to work with Elder Frazee. You know how conservative a person Elder Frazee was. But he was just a jewel to work with. I really enjoyed it. And during my 10 years at SPA, whenever he came through town, if he were driving through, he and his niece, who was his chauffeur, would stop at the publishing house mainly to come to my office to say hello and just visit for a few minutes. And I really appreciated that. Well, time is fleeting. Elder Harold E. Metcalf, a Southern Union ministerial secretary during my tenure there at SPA, had invested hours and hours of study into the books of Daniel and Revelation, and he wanted us to publish the book. He had been going around holding seminars around the country, telling people what he had found. He had been plumbing the depths of Daniel and Revelation. Well, one day he came to the publishing house in person, which always made me want to crawl under my desk. And he plopped this huge manuscript down and wanted us instantly, on the spot, to review it for him and to tell him we'd publish it. Well, you know, we didn't work that way. So that was rather disappointing. But he left quite disappointed. But I assured him we'd give the book due attention. And one of the first evaluators I chose was my associate editor there, Don Short, son of the Don Short of Wheeland & Short, 1888 fame. And Don began looking through it, and he said to himself, boy, some of this stuff sounds awfully familiar. And so he just started kind of checking it out, and he began rifling through some of the other books that the church has published by Uriah Smith and S.N. Haskell and Taylor G. Bunch. And he discovered that most of the book, maybe even close to 90% or more of Elder Metcalf's book, was taken directly from these authors with no quotation marks and no references as to where he had gotten the ideas. Word for word. Word for word. Well, Elder Metcalf was somewhat of a bombast, which didn't go well with me. And I decided, okay, I've had enough. So I wrote him a one-sentence letter, and I violated all the principles I had of being nice to authors. And in my one sentence, I said, "Dear Elder Metcalf, Southern Publishing Association does not accept for publication plagiarized material. Sincerely." It's probably not the most brilliant thing I ever did. Well, a few days later, guess what? Secretary came in and said, "Elder Metcalf would like to talk to you. He's on the phone." Well, I wasn't out of the office. So we had a little talk, and I'll tell you, when I picked up the handset, smoke was curling out of it, you know, out of the earpiece. He was very angry, and he defended himself, telling me that these men, at least Elder Bunch, did the same thing. He just, these guys quoted everybody and never put quotation, they stole everything. Well, I didn't think that was good enough argument. And so he asked, well, If I rewrote it, would you look at it again? Well, sure, sure. You know, we'll be happy to do that, Elder Metcalf. Well, after I hung up the phone, I said, you know, I learned how authors deal with editors. They send with their manuscript this, if you've ever shown any interest at all in them, with a letter. This is the book you asked for, you know, which is to put the pressure on you to, yeah, you better knuckle under and do this. And I said, oh, you know, Elder Metcalf's going to do that. Here is the rewritten manuscript that you wanted. So, knowing that Elder Metcalf could be a real thinker, spelled with T-H, as in Stanley, I decided to write him another letter. Because he showed no sign of remorse at all in on the phone. So I told him that I'm sorry, but you showed no indication of feeling bad about what you've done. And so here's my reconstruction of the letter as close as I could come to it. Thank you for your phone call today. As agreed, we will give careful attention to your book should you rewrite it and resubmit it for publication. Possible publication, by the way. That's a key term I learned early on. Possible publication. Elder Metcalf, I must admit that I was taken aback at your defensive attitude. Whether others, such as Elder Bunch, have plagiarized, I do not know. I do know that from our investigation, more than 90% of your manuscript is pirated from Elders Smith, Haskell, and Bunch. During our phone conversation, you steadfastly defended your plagiarism and showed absolutely no regret for having done so. Plagiarism is illegal. It is also immoral. It breaks one of the Ten Commandments, the one that says, thou shalt not steal. It's like breaking the commandment that says, thou shalt not commit adultery. Sincerely. Yeah. Well, a few days later, guess what? My phone rang again, and my secretary said it was Elder Metcalf on the phone, and he assured me in loud and vigorous tones that he had not committed adultery. One thing we tried to do, it was Bob Nixon's idea, I can't take credit for it, but when he left, just before he left for his law degree, he said, we need to publish a series of books that would kind of feature Adventist academics, scholars, and try to make some of their great ideas available to the church at large. And so we did a survey of 20 graduates from 1965, from Loma Linda University, School of Dentistry, from Adventist International Medical Society, from pastors, from teachers, and we had various options. What kind of topics would you be interested in? Archaeology was one of them. We had scientific items there, and theological issues, and ethical issues. Interestingly, ethical issues were at the very bottom of the heap of interest. Archaeology was at the top, really, at the top. Well, we came up with the Anvil series. Maybe some of you remember those square formatted books. And I believe that one of the first ones, or maybe it was the first one, was Gottfried Osterwald's Mission Possible. We took that, television program was popular. We ripped that place off. And another one that we had a lot of fun with was Charlie Wycherby's God Invented Sex. Do you remember that book? That was one of our, that book helped the ABC sell a lot of books. Because you see, the customer would come in and they didn't know how to pronounce his last name. That's a hard name. So they would, they'd get this book, and they'd get this book, and they'd get this book, and this book, and then they'd put Charlie's book on the bottom, you know, and they'd carry a pile of four or five books to the counter to get them checked out. Now, I don't know, Bob, if you were here at that time or not at the seminary. I came to their chapel to give Charlie the first off-the-press book, and what we did is we had one specially made for Charlie. It was in a plain brown cover. A around the 1970s, mid-1970s, the book editors at SPA said, you know, we need to do a systematic theology. The church needs to have a systematic theology. What can we do? So we actually got permission from the higher-ups, also known as GC administrators. And they said, sure, go ahead. But the advice we got was that it must not be an officially GC sanctioned. You know, the publishing house can do it, and that's fine, but you can't even call it a Seventh-day Adventist systematic theology, you know, because that would make it too official. Well, okay, you know, anything we could do. Well, we wanted to do this. So when I was here at the seminary visiting one time, I got into the office of, you know this man, W.G.C. Murdoch. Didn't you love his, would it be a brogue or what you'd call it? Beautiful, beautiful accent. And he got pretty excited about it. He said, can I be the general editor of this? And he began writing on a little slip of paper how he would, you know, organize the book, the kind of an overall arching organization from it. And this was great to have the dean of the seminary at the time, you know, be the overseeing editor, this was going to be great. And so I returned to the publishing house with this little sketchy outline that I had. We shared. I shared this with my colleagues there. And they waited. I waited. We waited. More than a year went by. Still waited. I continued to write to Dr. Murdoch and didn't budge Ayers Rock at all. Nothing. Nothing. Well, a couple of years later, he was a busy man. A couple of years later, here again at AU, I happened to mention the project to Gottfried Osterwald. I was in his office and I mentioned this. Oh, he said, can I be the editor of that? Oh, please. You know, it was like, I don't know, he just was so excited. Well, what do I do? I mean, the dean of the seminary was supposed to be doing this, but of course nothing was happening. And so I was told to write a very lovely, kind, sweet letter to Dr. Murdoch and let him off the hook as gently as possible and get Gottfried then to let loose and get this thing going. So that's what we did. And a couple of more years rolled by, and the new general editor, despite his initial enthusiasm, produced the same amount of material that Dr. Murdoch did. Yeah. And so then we merged. The two houses merged in 1980, the Review and Herald and SPA. And I was visiting with my friend and colleague there who had been the head book editor there, Ray Woolsey. And as we were talking, I discovered that he had gotten General Conference permission to do the same kind of thing. And apparently they hadn't gotten much farther than we had, but anyway, I thought, well, that's rather interesting. So we kind of united our endeavors and got to talk to George Reed at BRI. And George said, yeah, well, why don't we kind of pool our expertise and resources? We'll try to get things going for you, and you do all the editing and all that, and sure, why not? He maybe had more leverage with the busy kind of people that we would need. And so George and I got together and began working on it. And BRI was going to be our unseen partner in this. They were not going to be upfront with it. George also reported to the proper GC committee what they were going to be doing, and yeah, that's okay. And we did find several of our theologians now ready to write, who are, and you know, it's terrible, you know, for $200 or $100, would you write this? You know, it's busy people. It was, well, we finally got a handful of articles, entries, so to, you know, I guess we would call them chapters. And the quality ranged from what I would say would be an A+ to a D D-plus for a college term paper, you know. And I won't mention the name of that author. He has been a friend for many years. But still, things did not work. And finally, George and I sat down to lick our wounds, and we half-heartedly agreed that it's a no-go. It's just not working. It is not working. And then one day, the GC committee turned to George, and they said, George, what's happening with that the systematic theology project? Nothing's happening. We've laid it to rest. It's just not working. And the committee said, absolutely not. It has to go through. It has to be done. And so at the 1988 annual council convening in Nairobi, it was officially voted that this project would be handed over to BRI as an official assignment. Now it's really official. And what that ended up meaning is that the General Conference actually took the project from the publishing house and made it an assignment for BRI to carry out. And there would be no editing at the publishing house done other than basic proofreading to see that, you know, words are spelled right, but very little of that. And it did become part of the Seventh-day Adventist Commentary Reference Series. We weren't sure if that was the proper venue to put a book like that, but finally decided, well, probably would work best there. And so that's how that book came to be. Raoul Dederen and Nancy Wehmeister were the editors of the project. And about 25 years after SPA had first gotten permission to do this kind of thing, the book got out as volume 12. Well, I was going to mention Rick Rice and Openness of God. We had a fun time with that one. What else was I going to mention here? Oh, Perfect in Christ by Helmut Ott. You may have remembered that one. That brought us, Pacific Press at the same time had published another book that was, quote, controversial. I don't remember what it was, but I think it might have been something to do with the nature of Christ or something. And Neil Wilson was not all that happy with both publishing houses for coming out with these two controversial books. And so he called us into his little, he had his office there at the GC, and then right adjacent to it was the boardroom. And he called us into the boardroom. People from Pacific Press and the Review, and we were sitting around here with the vice presidents and the GC secretariat people, you know, and as Neil is wont to do, it began with a long speech, you know. Brilliant mind that man had, believe me, brilliant mind. If you've ever dealt with Elder Neil Wilson, you know, brilliant mind. Can't say that some other things Elder Wilson did, but a brilliant mind. And he had just been done, and basically he was turning the floor over to the good folk at Pacific Press and the Review to defend our, you know, we were going to have to defend ourselves for publishing this terrible material. And I believe it was Charles Bradford at the time who, before any of us had to say anything, spoke up and he said, Mr. Chairman, has the church taken an official position on either of these topics? And Elder Wilson said, well, no. And Brad said, then why are we here? The meeting ended pretty abruptly. The Inquisition was over, hardly had begun, and we were on our way. Also, of course, we did Alden Thompson's book on inspiration and revelation. We had looked for a book on this for a long time. None of our buddies, Bob, at the seminary and elsewhere, wanted to touch the topic, you know. And finally, we got someone who was going to write it. And then Alden came along and said, oh, I would like to do it. Well, we had someone on the line to do it. But that manuscript never came through, so we got Alden's. Bible story copyright. We had an issue with that, and I had to deal with copyright matters. And we, at that point in the 1950s, you had to renew copyright after 28 years. Now, originally, it had to be not only 28 years, but on the anniversary date of publication. That's why publishing houses always wanted to own copyright, because they were afraid authors would never remember. Well, by this time, it didn't have to be anniversary date, but it had to be in the 28th year. And as I was going through the files, trying to find out how things had been handled, how, you know, was everything hunky-dory with copyright, I discovered that some of the original books published by, Bible story books published in the 1950s, they had not separated copyright request for illustrations other than the text itself. Now, that's what they should have done. They should have had separate copyrights for the illustrations and separate copyrights for the texts. They didn't do that. And the review, you know, regardless of how you wanted to think about the quality of the Bible story and its illustrations, they spent tens of thousands of dollars for all this. Well, when it was renewed, when you renewed copyright, you had to renew in the name of the author. You could not renew in the name of the publisher. And so when these books were renewed, the copyright was renewed, Malcolm Maxwell, who was trustee of the estate now, the estate owned all the artwork that the review had, as well as the text. I mentioned this to Bud Otis, who was the president at the time, and I mean literally within a couple of days, I was on a plane going out to California to see Malcolm at PUC. I had in my case two sets of documents. One set Malcolm could sign that would return copyright to the illustrations to the publishing house. The estate would continue to hold copyright to the text. The other set of documents was all of it goes back to the publishing house. Malcolm would sign all the rights back to the review. Well, Malcolm, I had gotten to be very fond of Malcolm over the years. He was of all the boys, Malcolm was a good one to be in charge of the estate. He was a real gem to deal with. And when I sat there, I was sitting in front of his desk, and I told him this sordid story that I had. I didn't tell him how many documents I had. And he loved this. He was thrilled. And he picked up the phone, without saying a word, he picked up the phone, he dialed his wife, and he said, "Honey, guess what? We own everything to Bible Story, everything, the pictures and everything." And then he hung up and he gave me a big grin, a big smile, and he said, "Well, how do we solve this?" And I said, "Well, we'd like you to sign these documents returning everything to the publishing house." And he said, "Be happy to do that." And so that's how that happened. Went to Glacier View. That was an experience. Remember the infamous Glacier View? Family Bible Story. I have four volumes here, four books here. You're welcome to look at them. Please don't steal them, because these books, as far as I know, all the insides that had been printed and never bound have been destroyed, because I consider this one of my highlights of my publishing career, and the marketing people didn't see it that way. And so the books were never marketed well, and as a result, they have not sold well, and the last I knew, they were going to destroy the whole 20,000 or whatever number they had in the warehouse that had not yet been bound. You know, just the inside signatures. We did a lot of research for these books. We did, I think it was either 11 or 12 focus groups across the country. People who had used Bible Story, people who knew nothing about Bible Story, children, oh, that was a fun one, doing a focus group with children. You know how they do focus groups? They have finger food out there and soft drinks and everything, and you're there for a couple of hours, and the little kids, you know, they're drinking the soda pop just like this, and so we had to stop the whole focus group about halfway through so we could have a potty break, you know, because all these little kids are in here, you know, dancing around, just couldn't take it. And we tested color. What color should be the major color? Can it be blue? Do you want dust jackets or no dust jackets? Parents said no dust jackets, and kids said dust jackets, yes. Should the type be justified or unjustified? Should it be in columns? What kind of artwork should we have? Should it be kind of realistic, or you know, should it be more cartoony or whimsical? No, it had to be realistic style. We also did something. Finally, after all this, we also did something that we thought was very important. At the bottom of each story, as the story started, we put the text, a condensed version of the text that the story was based on, because this subliminally said, this story is not fake, this story is based on the Bible. We also wanted illustrations with captions, but the captions couldn't repeat what was said in the story. It should add additional information. We also wanted a Bible bedtime story for the younger set in the book. Same story, but dumbed down for preschoolers. We discovered in Maxwell's Bible story that the age range of readability varied greatly. Many, many steps of grade difference. So this was all going to be, as I recall, it was at a fourth grade reading level with a controlled vocabulary. One other thing we had wanted to do, let's see if I can find one. Yeah, we wanted to have what we initially called drop-ins, a box that would deal with something tangential or part of the story, but in more depth for adults. So that's why we decided to call it a family Bible story. So there was something for everyone in the family. And this one is on famines in the ancient Near Eastern world. And then at the back, we had a little Bible dictionary glossary that would mention, give information on every proper name, proper noun used in the text of the book. And kids like things, how do you pronounce such things? So, you know, we relied on Leona Running. She actually was delighted to do this. She said she was. Does Leona lie? I hope not. She did all this for us. It was so wonderful. She was such a help to us. She even read the text. How we got to these authors is we conducted a contest. We chose certain authors that were good authors. We sent them all the same stories, one Old Testament, one New Testament story to write. And they came back, we took the names off, and we sent the stories out to all kinds of readers, children, adults, pastors, scholars, people like, for Old Testament, our old friend Larry Herr, you know, got their feedback. We ended up asking Ruth Brand at AUC to write the stories for us, and we ended up with two authors for the Bible bedtime stories to kind of switch on and off to do those stories for us. You're welcome to look at them. I'm pretty proud of the books. I think they've done a service. I wish they had sold better. But anyway, it's too long. I've gone too long. Questions, I suppose, Gary. What?
Questions,
David.
I don't know if this is urban legend or if it's the truth, but I remember hearing that Alden Thompson's book, Inspiration, was so controversial that you were allowed to publish it, but not market it. Broaden the answer, your answer, not just this book, but were there other books that were somewhat taboo, but that you published, but that you couldn't promote? And what were those books, and how did the story unfold on those blacklisted books?
Alden's was controversial. I don't personally recall any don't market it kind of thing. There is one, and that was Rick Rice's book on the openness of God. And that had been accepted by Southern Publishing Association just before the merger. And so when we merged and went northward, the book was still controversial then, or more controversial. I mean, we had lots of good reviews. And when we asked people to evaluate books, depending on the book, but we could have as many as 10 or 12 different people evaluating. And we tried to choose people, not that we wanted to unbalance the scales, but we wanted it so that we knew these people would read it with an open mind. So we got excellent reviews of Rick's book. We published it. People started, we started getting some complaints. I didn't. Apparently they went to Neil. And because of that, the president of the Review and Herald, Bud Otis, decided that we would take the book from the market. And so skids of these books miraculously disappeared, and no one knew where they went. Having worked at Southern Pub so closely with authors, giving them periodic reports as to how their books were doing, I wrote to Rick and explained to him that because the book was controversial, the publishing house had decided to withdraw it from the marketplace. I thought it was only fair to let Rick know. At the time, Elder Wilson was on a trip abroad. I believe he was in Africa. When he got back, he got the news that the book had been pulled from the market, and he phoned me. And if Elder Wilson had been the kind of person who would cuss, it would have been some phone conversation. He was furious, to put it mildly. He was not happy. He said, I told Bud Otis, I don't know why he told me, I told Bud Otis to treat that book with benign neglect. I did not want it removed from the marketplace. Well, Elder Wilson, I don't know. I guess you're going to have to talk to somebody else. You better talk to Elder Otis. Oh, he did. And miraculously again, skids of these books appeared in the warehouse. Books that no one knew where they had gone. They had just disappeared, and now they were back in the warehouse, miraculously. And the book did quite well. Now, the other side of the story is, Elder Otis put me on trial at the management committee, the executive committee at the publishing house, because he said I had violated the sacred confidentiality of that committee by telling the author that his book was no longer in circulation. Well, I suppose technically the head of the book department, at that time we had book department and editorial department, we were separated. I suppose at that time it would have been very nice if the book department manager had done that. It would have been his lot to really have done that. But kind of knowing the individual, I pretty much assumed, rightly, that no letter had ever gone out to the author and wasn't going to go out to the author. So I took it upon myself to do it. So in our executive committee there, our management committee, whatever they called it, Elder Otis told the group what had gone on and how I had violated the sanctity of their privacy, you know, of making decisions. And he said, now I will let Richard defend himself. So I tried to defend myself and explain why I did what I did to the group. And then Elder Otis said, okay, Richard, please leave the room, and we are going to decide whether or not you can continue to be a member of this management committee. So I left the room, and they talked it over, and because of grace, I was allowed to come back and be a member of that committee still, providing I swore that I would never violate the confidentiality of this group ever again. Which I was, of course, happy to do, because I didn't really think I was had done that. And I say this kindly, because Elder Otis and I got along pretty well. But this was a pretty rocky a pretty rocky point in both of our relationships there on that. That was the main one. They didn't want to reprint Alden's book, and I think it ultimately did get reprinted again. But for a while, it was out. Yeah. That one, we had a marvelous story on that one, how controversial that was among the readers. We had the biggest book committee you've ever seen, with people showing up from BRI and everywhere showing up to defend or detract from this book that Alden had written. Oh, it was a hoot.
Excuse me. I was going to say something privately to you, but I thought I better say it in front of everybody now. I want to give you thanks, because I owe you a lot. You came to me and asked me to write a book for Southern Pub, and I am sure that you were going out on a limb, because by that time I was already teaching at St. Mary's. And I remember the meeting we had in your motel in Benton Harbor that night, in which you insisted that I wasn't even dreaming of writing a book. I had no book in my mind at all when you invited me to come and see you. And I wrote Paul of Tarsus, His Gospel and Life. By the time the book, it took me a while to get it done, but I did do it. By that time, you were in the Review and Herald. And the Review and Herald was not interested.
Yeah.
But in a way, everything worked very, very fine, because eventually the book was published by Andrews University Press. Mm. And it has been a very good book for me to have published. So I want to thank you, because it would never have come out, and I probably would not have written another book if I had not written that one. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Harold. Harold's one of the good guys. I'll tell you, I'm so fond of Harold. He didn't tell you that he and his wife treated me to a meal at their home, too.
I don't remember.
Yeah, well, I do, Harold. So sweet, so nice, so loving, so kind. Also, it was my privilege that year when I was the ASRS president to ask Harold if he would present a paper at our annual meeting, too. And Harold did a bang-up job, as, of course, you would expect. thank you, Harold. I just think of you often and how faithful you have been despite all you've gone through. Thank you. You've been an inspiration to me, personally. Two people have really been, well, I can't start saying everybody, because so many people, but two people especially have been an inspiration to me. One has been Harold. Even though we can't really call ourselves bosom buddies, we haven't been together very much. And the other person that I have, I'm talking psychologically now, especially, of a help, and the other was Sakai Kubo. And all that he went through, and the Christian, sweet Christian spirit, Sakai, always manifested, always manifested. Oh, I'll tell you, we've had some great, you know, I knew most of, not other disciplines other than biblical and theological people. We've had some great people in our church, some wonderful people. I'll tell you, just super.
Adventist authors and publishing houses have come up with some pretty groundbreaking books. in a variety of areas and not just books like Richard Rice's. Why the resistance to marketing to the public, and why are we still just marketing to the Adventist market?
Boy. Oh, you're talking to the wrong person. The editors have always been pushing for more expansive marketing, making actually fools of ourselves sometimes inside the publishing house, being pests. The marketing people are good people, no question. I have no question about that. But they're doing what they know to do and what they know best. They've grown up within our system, as I have, but they've grown up in ABCs or as literature evangelists. That's where they come into the publishing house from. These are the only two marketing venues they know for outlets. That's all. And so it's only natural that they're going to put their efforts into those areas that they know best. Now, for a while, Pacific Press tried to pioneer this, reaching out a little bit, and had joined the Christian Booksellers Association and had every year at their annual conference a display there. And they, from what I was told, never found that they had sufficient returns financially to make it worthwhile to even go there and do that, because it was an expensive proposition. The Review tried to do some of this a little bit. It didn't work, I think, probably again, because we didn't know how to do it. We didn't quite know. Now, there has been this issue of prejudice, of course, out there, too. We don't want to, evangelical marketplaces don't want to peddle Adventist books. It's there, but I'm not sure it's been there as much as, you know, we've seen it. Remember the spies who came back from the Promised Land? We're like grasshoppers compared with the giants there. I think that got exaggerated within the publishing houses, too. I don't have a good answer. When we started talking about this series, Family Bible Story series, Elder Otis, by the way, he jumped on this one right away. He ran with it. He understood the issues. He understood the marketing research that had been done for it. And boy, he pushed this as hard as he could. Now, among the literature evangelists, Elder Otis was a persona non grata by and large. And so his enthusiasm for the project was great for those of us in the house who needed his support as our president, but it did us absolutely no good and did us a lot of harm for those outside the house, because you know, Arthur Maxwell was inspired by God when he wrote the Bible stories. I mean, literally, we heard that. We heard that. And so we said, this kind of set, we want to have several prongs in our marketing. Sure, of course, within the Adventist Book Center system, yes. Sure, we can make it available to the LEs, sure. But we also want to make it available through direct mail. We even talked about infomercials on television and that kind of thing. I mean, we at our focus groups, we had enthusiasm like you wouldn't believe for this. I remember leaving one, and this man who had had Bible story when he was a kid. he said, we even bought it for our kids. And he said, boy, are those things expensive. They were. But he said, when will this be out? When will this be out? He could hardly wait. But again, you know, it's areas that we just aren't all that familiar with. And when we aren't familiar with something, you know, the human tendency, we tend to just kind of step back. I don't know. I don't have a good answer. That's my fumbling answer.
Could you speak about the financial considerations, which are probably a part of your decision-making process?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. The financial considerations, every time the book committee, maybe you don't know this, every time the book committee accepts a book for publication and writes to the author and says, we've accepted your book for publication, that is not the last word. The book goes to a marketing group in the marketing area, and they run the, you know, they run the cost of goods and all that and decide there whether they think the book can be published or not. And if they don't like the finances of it, that book we accepted at the book committee is sent back to the author. Now, that's tough. Second thing, Arthur Maxwell was well known in the publishing world, by the way, outside the Adventist Church. He had some close friends in the Reader's Digest publishing group. And they used to kid him. And they used to say, oh, said, the Adventist Church must be so rich because they can afford several manufacturing plants, you know, binderies and presses and all that. Poor Reader's Digest, we just, you know, we can't afford any of that. We have to have all our manufacturing done somewhere else. This has been a problem since 1970, at least, when I joined SPA. Our cost of goods within the publishing house are inordinately higher than if we had the books manufactured elsewhere. First, we can't keep our, generally we cannot keep our equipment running around the clock. With a web press, the conventional wisdom has been, don't even look at one if you're only going to operate one shift. If you operate two shifts, you might break even. You need to operate three shifts around the clock to make a profit. Rarely have our publishing houses used our presses three shifts. And then, of course, we have Fridays afternoons off, or Friday, all Fridays off, and Sabbaths off in addition. Our cost of goods has been much higher by many factors than if we had them manufactured outside, which also then, while maybe our retail price is kind of comparable, though some people always thought we charged too much in the ABCs, our retail prices have tended to be rather comparable. But with the cost of goods so high, we don't make it. We don't make the profit we need to make. And when we went into this, our treasurer at the review was very much for the project, but against the project because she could not see a financial return on it. And she was right. I fought her tooth and nail. But she understood that the marketing people weren't going to get behind it. And she actually told me that one time. If the marketing people aren't behind it, forget it. I don't know. We're still doing our manufacturing. Still doing it. Dear friend of mine, I won't say his name because you'd know him. Dear friend, good person, you don't want your Signs of the Times magazine being printed on the same presses that print Playboy.
Before I ask my question, I just want to say that your devotional, Snapshots of God, is one of the best and one that I still remember. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Bob. You know there's a story behind that, don't you?
No, I don't. That,
yeah, it's been destroyed.
Been destroyed?
The stock has been destroyed.
Oh.
Yeah. It's heretical. The book is heretical.
Oh. Well, I enjoyed it, I guess. Yeah. Well, anyway.
Hey, Bob, Leona and I are pen pals now. Pen pals now. We write every few weeks to each other. She has adopted me as her brother because of that book.
Oh, okay. Well, the question I was going to ask, how do you see the future of Adventist publishing? You know, U.S. News and World Report has gone completely electronic, and Newsweek will at the end of this year. Yep. And that seems to be the wave of the future.
Yeah.
Would you like to prophesy a little bit?
No. I've been very concerned for our publishing houses. Now, you have to understand, I'm of the old school. I know paper and ink, you know? That's what I know. I also know, however, that we have this new challenge. Having worked for the Review for so many years, my heart has been there. The Pacific Press and the Review have been friendly competitors and sometimes unfriendly competitors. The Pacific Press, well, let's put it this way. The future of Adventist publishing, I think, will boil down to which house does the most has the most progressive, aggressive program in e-publishing. Now, Pacific Press started out, they wrote to all their authors and said, we don't care what your books are, even if they were already, you know, in print, but now you own the copyright, send us those books, we will turn them into e-books for you free. Whoa, so I fired off an email to my old buddies, you know, there at Review and said, hey, what are you guys doing? Look at what Pacific's doing. I got good news, I think. Right now, if I understand it correctly, every hard book, I'm not talking about hardcover, but you know, every paper hard book they print, they now make an e-version available. Good. And I hope they do better. I hope they keep going. I hate e-books. I hate reading on the screen. In fact, I do a little freelance editing once in a while. Even now, I will edit once on the screen. I will print it all out, and I will edit on hard copy. And I'm embarrassed at what I've missed, you know, on screen. I don't like it. However, I think I have maybe 4 books now on Kindle that I've put up there. And I'm working on Snapshots of God to sometime get that up on Kindle. Bob, go ahead. An anonymous pastor scholar in Michigan wrote a 2-page critique of my book, Snapshots, which got in the hands of ABC managers and basically destroyed the sales. Now, the critique was a very strange critique. I wrote, I think, a 14-page response to this anonymous 2-page critique. It dealt with things like this. I said, when discussing 2 Timothy 3:16, Theopneustos, God breathed, kind of reminds me of what happened in Eden when God breathed into Adam the breath of life. It makes God's word a living word for us. This anonymous critic said, well, that is not mentioned in Seventh-day Adventist Believe book by, was it the Domsteeds who wrote that book? It's not mentioned in there, therefore this, you know, this is heretical. I said on 3 John that I'm not sure that passage, you know, I wish you're above all you were in good health, that I'm not sure that's really a great proof text for healthful living when you have so many others you could use, because this was a very common way of talking to people in letters at that time, just like we do it today. I even do it in my emails. You know, hey, Bob, hope this email finds you in good health and all. And so I said, this is phatic language. Phatic language is the soft fuzzies. Good buddy, how are things going? You know, it's the phatic, it's the kind of language we use just to kind of break down barriers. Think of the lady in the elevator. She's going up to the 900th floor, and on the 20th floor, this big brute of a guy with tattoos all over cuts into the elevator, and boy, she starts backing up against the wall, you know, and he turns to her and says, "Boy, pretty lousy weather out there today, isn't it?" Ah, you know? It's phatic language. It's phatic language. And so that was my argument there. Well, this proved that I didn't believe in the 28 fundamental beliefs of the church, and especially the fundamental belief on standards and healthful living, which I found rather interesting since I'm a lifelong vegetarian, was raised one. The only meat I've ever eaten is, I think, when I was out in the woods and I swallowed a mosquito or two, you know. But anyway, that's part of it, Bob.
Bob already asked.
Could you make some comment about the territorial? It's caught on because we started it here in the States, and now the world does it.
Yeah.
I'll give you some examples. My wife has books printed in South America and in America, and they take turns deciding which they want, but they won't exchange them between each other because it's against the law. And we can't get them, any of them, up here in the States because book ABCs can't sell them because they're printed overseas.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that. But, you know, it's not just internationally. It's highly territorial within the U.S.,
Yes, I canvassed 4 years to get through medical school, and I could never get anything from the review because I was working in California,
yep.
And I wanted to very, very badly.
Yep, you've got it. You've got it. And sometimes it could get pretty heated between the two publishing houses. I don't know what the present status is on the territory within. I can only speak within our country right now, and I can't speak to the latest. The way the rules had been set up is that the Review and Herald for ABCs was to stock and distribute in its territory Pacific Press books. And Pacific Press in its territory was to stock and distribute review books. I'm talking about ABC books, trade books. That's the technical term, trade books. Not subscription books, like you've had an issue with that. You understand that. I suppose both houses at one time or another, because of this arrangement, have pointed the finger at the other guy and said, you are withholding selling our books. And if you have a book on a similar topic, you sell that to the ABC and encourage the ABCs to buy that book, not ours. How much of that is true? I don't know. I suspect that some of it has been. They've tried to break down some of those barriers. I know they've tried to do that. How successful it is now, I don't know. The last I knew, they were talking about wanting to let Review do the whole country and Pacific do the whole country. The HHES end of things, that's another matter. And that's another sad story. And I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know it's a sad story.
I'd like to ask about the concept of the sort of the free market idea in publishing. It seems that the history is the feeling that we have to protect Adventism from something, from dangerous ideas.
Yeah.
Philosophically, why don't we have more of a, well, here's one view, here's another mm-hmm. view, here's another view.
Yeah.
And let people decide, read the books and figure out which way you go.
Yeah.
And most of us know, it tilts toward a conservative
yes.
view of things,
yes.
and the fear is that a progressive or liberal point mm-hmm. of view is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Is that gonna change? Is that what's your reaction?
Oh, I think it will change. I think it's going to change, but I don't think it's going to change the way you and I want it to go.
You mean it's going to become more restrictive?
I believe so. And I have a good reason for understanding that, which I will not state publicly because it's being recorded. Okay. I think that's one thing Elder Bradford was trying to get at when we had that meeting near Neil's office. Has the church taken an official stand on this? If not, why are we here? We did a book on perfection, Christian perfection, in the Anvil series with, what was it? Was it four different views or five different views?
Four. Yes, I remember that. Very well done.
We tried, we wanted to do another one. Oh, I forget what the topic was. And the participants we were talking with were even, well, at least one of them did not want to be found in association with the others. Yeah.
You understand, I mean, those of us that come from the academic world, we're sort of influenced by academic publishing.
Yeah.
And they sort of throw it all out there.
Of course.
And they have high standards, but they say, we don't decide, our readers decide.
That's right. And see, too, there's the financial end of it, Gary.
Yeah.
You know, how many of our people in the pew are starving for various views, or do they want more to reinforce their traditional view? So if you publish more of these books that are the traditional view, they're going to sell real well, where the others, well, you know.
Well, I think it has to do with the educational level. Maybe in the 40s and 50s, the pastor and the medical doctor were the most educated.
Yeah.
But I think that's changing.
I think it is, yes.
Fairly significantly.
Yeah.
Does this open the door for an independent Adventist publisher?
Well, we have some. We have Adventist Today.
Spectrum.
We have Spectrum. We had our late friend, Sam Bakayoki, who did very well. With his
Remnant Press.
Yes. Is that the one? There's one in northern New England. Is it Remnant Press? No, okay. There was one in northern New England, too, that was doing some work. Leaves of Autumn, is that what it was? I don't know. But there have been several of these organizations. Some of them there's another one. Oh, can't come up with the name. Have done very well. Have done very well. Some, of course, are conservative. Some are more progressive. But yes, that has been happening. At the same time, please understand. The General Conference has done precious little interference with the book committees at Southern Pub, Review and Herald, and Pacific Press, okay? Done precious little interference. Now, when we had Alden's book there being considered, well, I'll tell you, we had a crowd, and we had a lot of talk, but it passed unanimously. Now, there were abstentions, okay? But it passed unanimously, despite some of the things stated by people from the General Conference. But the General Conference normally has kept at arm's length. Now, some of that is because we have not, well, we have purposely tried to avoid their input on certain things. Not that we don't like the GC Brethren. I like them. Man, I like them. But, you know, must we send everything to BRI for its stamp of approval, you know? No. Pacific Press, I have secondhand knowledge, has said we do not send stuff to BRI to review. It's not because they don't like the people there, but it just gives them a little more, you know, arm's length from the GC. I understand that the Review and Herald doesn't do that a whole lot either. We certainly didn't do it a whole lot when I was there, though we have done it occasionally. I think the GC has also generally has appreciated that stance. They don't want to get the reputation that they're micromanaging everything that, you know, every little organization in the church. So they've been pretty good. I don't want to downplay, you know, I don't want to get you leave you with the feeling that the GC is some big ogre up here trying to tell the publishing houses every little move. They've been, I think, by and large, they've been pretty good.
we're throwing out accolades. I'll finish with one. I still think, and I believe you edited this, correct me if I'm wrong, I still think Edward Vick's book, Speaking Well of God,
hey, forgot to pay the rent,
is one of the best Adventist doctrinal statements of of God that we've done. Well, let's thank Richard Coffin.
By the way, just to say something about Vick. Dr. Vick was a joy to edit. Now, it's not the most scintillating reading I've ever dealt with, but one point leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. It's so much fun to follow this man's thinking, just like that. I don't know about reading it, you know, popular reading, I'm not sure, but it was a joy to work with his material.